Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Ken. So I can say that this is a wonderful interdisciplinary audience, just as I like it to be. And because of that, I would very much encourage you and ask you to please interrupt me and ask questions, because there are things I may say that make no sense to some of you and other things that makes no sense to the other part of the audience. Please do interrupt me and ask questions. Since Ken went over my path, I'm not going to spend too much time on it. I would just say that from early on, I was fluctuating between being mathematician, physicist, and chemist. And I ended up studying biology at MIT after doing the International Science Olympiads. A lot of my work during my PhD in the Botstein lab focused on understanding how gene regulation and metabolism are coordinated with growth rate. And then I pursued one of the biggest challenges in that field when I started my postdoc, which was understanding the role of aerobic glycolysis. And I already discussed this with some of you and can discuss it further in our meetings. But today, I want to focus only on a discovery that I made unexpectedly while studying aerobic glycolysis, because this is the work that I want to carry out further that has informed my future proposed research, which is how the ribosomes can regulate translation, not the only passive participants. So by way of introduction, we know of very many examples where the rate at which messenger RNA is being translated is being regulated. This is one very classical example of developing fly embryos, where the gradient of the bicoid mRNA is essential for the development, and not only the gradient, but the precise regulation of how the mRNA is being translated into the protein is essential. And from this classical, very well-studied example is actually not isolated, as you can see here, from a distribution across the human proteome of how many proteins are being produced per mRNA per unit time, per hour. And you can see that different genes have very different efficiencies of translation. For some mRNAs, this is only one protein per hour, and for others, it's 10,000. And we still don't understand very well what are the factors that give rise to this wide variation. There are a couple of examples in which the ribosome itself can participate in determining how well proteins are being translated. And one such example is in fly development in the germplasm. Some mRNAs, such as the mRNA coding for GCL, a particular gene, is being translated in part by mitochondrial ribosomes. You know that normally mitochondria have their own distinct ribosomes. They're inside of the mitochondria, and in this case, they translate cytoplasmic mRNAs. And another example from development comes from mice, where the protein RPL38, you're going to hear a lot of RPs today, that stands for ribosomal protein of the large subunit 38, just a gene, that's required for the translation of Hox mRNAs. These are essential developmental genes, and they control the patterning of the development of vertebrate development in mice. But of course, I'm sure that those of you in the audience who have studied translation know these are the exceptions of the rule. The general rule is that as we convert the information from DNA to protein to biological functions in the central dogma, there are very many layers of regulation that have been identified, but the ribosome is not one of them. So the ribosome is generally this very beautiful macromolecular complex that I'm showing here. It's made out of, as any textbook would tell you, of four ribosomal RNAs and 80 core ribosomal proteins, one ribosomal protein of each type in one subunit per ribosome. So there are all these other regulatory functions, all these other regulatory layers, but the ribosome is considered just to be this passive player. And while I was studying aerobic glycolysis, I obtained this piece of data that made me question whether ribosomes are so passive and initiated the work that I'm going to tell you about. And in particular, what I'm showing here is a piece of data of quantifying the core ribosomal proteins, the constituents of this particle. There are all of them here that I'm showing, the rows of this matrix, and they're quantified by quantitative mass spectrometry across three different conditions. And you can see that while some of them increase in abundance, others decrease in abundance. And this is a little bit hard to reconcile with all of these proteins being part of the same fixed complex. And I thought it's a very exciting possibility worth further investigation, since this is, of course, the universally conserved machinery of one of the most fundamental biological processes. And the possibility that it itself can be different and participate in regulating the expression of genetic information is something that I thought is very interesting. Before I tell you about all the things that they did to study this in more details, I have to tell you that I'm not the first one to think of that idea. There have been other people that have speculated about ribosome specialization. In particular, one piece of data is measuring the mRNAs in different tissues or different time points in different samples. And these are the mRNAs coding for the core ribosomal proteins. And here you can see that in the developing embryo, they have this sort of checkerboard pattern of expression where some ribosomal proteins are high in some tissues, others are high in other tissues. But these data are extremely indirect in the sense that we don't know if these mRNAs are actually being translated to protein. And we don't know if the proteins are being degraded or not, and we don't know if they're being incorporated into the complex. So I had exactly the same predicament with my data from the Bostein lab. So what I'm showing here, again, are the mRNAs for the ribosomal proteins in budding yeast growing at six different growth rates, from low growth rate to high growth rate. And you can see that generally at low growth rate, most ribosomal proteins are being transcribed at low levels, and their transcription increases with growth rate. As you would expect, the cells grow faster, they have to make more protein. But then there's this gradient here. Some increase much more, others increase much less, others actually decrease. And I never knew how to interpret it. I knew that this is reproducible. If I do biological replicas, I estimate my error bars, I still see this. But we had no way of interpreting it at that level. So this was just very suggestive observation.
Is this using one means for altering growth rate, or do you use different means?
So in this case, we're limiting for a glucose carbon source. And you observe very similar pattern if you limit for other nutrients, such as phosphate, ammonia, and so on. It's very, very similar. And then there is data coming out from the phenotypes of deleting ribosomal proteins. And here I'm going to focus on two particular observations. One of them comes from large-scale sequencing of human cancers. You don't need to be able to read all of these labels here. They're just different human cancers. And what I'm showing on the y-axis is the frequency with which different ribosomal proteins are being mutated. And you can see RPL22 being mutated in over 11% of all uterine carcinomas, but not at all in other cancers. And similarly, phenotypes of deleting ribosomal proteins are usually very specific for different developmental stages, for different cell types, and so on, which is suggestive that there isn't just some blunt general perturbation of the translational machinery, but perhaps something that is more specific. And the other example that I'm going to mention comes from a human disease that has been studied. It comes from haploinsufficiency of this particular gene here, RPS19. When RPS19 is being suppressed, a few hundred mRNAs are being translated more efficiently, while a few hundred others are translated less efficiently. And most of the transcriptome doesn't change its translational efficiency, so there is a very specific effect on some genes, not on most genes. But of course, these data show that deletions of ribosomal proteins have very specific effects on translation. They don't show that in wild-type cells, in the absence of deletions, there are these effects on the ribosome. And this is what I wanted to investigate, whether in unperturbed cells, in wild-type cells, we can still see this change in the ribosomal composition. And the first thing that I had to do is physically isolate ribosomes. Because if I'm just quantifying ribosomal proteins as part of the cytoplasm, it's part of the whole soup, then I don't know whether all the protein that they quantify comes from the ribosomes or comes from some other location in the cell. It's ribosomal functions. And fortunately, there is a very simple physical method for separating ribosomes simply by doing velocity sedimentation. Large objects sediment faster than smaller objects, and therefore we can separate the small, the large subunit. We can separate the ribosome, the monosomal peak, and then polysomes 2, 3, 4, and so on. And then I can take from each of these fractions, it's a separate tube, I can quantify the proteins using quantitative mass spectrometry and see whether the composition of the ribosomes is any different in these fractions. Now, how do you quantify proteins? Just a very quick intro to those of you who haven't done mass spec. Turns out that running the whole protein with mass spectrometry is very hard. So we first start by digesting it with enzymes that have specificities. In this case, trypsin cuts after certain amino acids. And it cuts at the red letters. And then the black are the peptide sequences of amino acids that then can be quantified. And these particular peptides occur only in that protein. I can quantify them across my conditions, and each of these peptides should correlate to the abundance of the actual protein. So by virtue of this, each of these rows, many of these matrices corresponds to one of the peptides, and the fact that they're so similar, it means the different peptides give the same quantitative estimate for the same protein, and they agree closely. And then, of course, you can do that for all the ribosomal proteins. And here is the result for the fractions from yeast cells grown in ethanol carbon source. So here you can see the monosomes, the trisomes, and the tetrosomes that they separated from the sucrose gradient. And you can see that now, even that they have separated just the ribosomes without the complication of other proteins, there's some ribosomal proteins more enriched in polysomes and others more enriched in the monosomes. You can do the same with yeast cells grown in glucose carbon source, and if you juxtapose the two results together, you can see that some ribosomal proteins depend more on the polysomal fraction. They depend how many ribosomes there are per mRNA. These are enriched in monosomes here and here, and these in the polysomes. But then the growth condition also impacts the composition of these proteins. If you compare the trisomes from ethanol carbon source and from glucose carbon source, you can see that they're quite different. So both the carbon source and the number of ribosomes found per mRNA affects the stoichiometry.
Can you explain a little more the significance of these different polysome fractions? This is message specific or condition specific?
Okay. So generally, the I'm going to go in a little bit more. Actually, this is a very good, I have a good slide for that. So we have a messenger RNA, and that messenger RNA can have 0, 1, 2, 3, or n number of ribosomes. And what are the factors that are going to determine the number of ribosomes? One is the rate of initiation. The more frequently translation is being initiated, the more frequently ribosomes hop, the higher the density. And the other is going to be the rate of elongation. The faster they move, the lower the density. And generally, people believe that translation is being regulated more at the rate of initiation, the hopping. And therefore, the messenger RNAs that have more ribosomes in them are the more actively translated mRNAs. So the polysomes are considered to be the more active ribosomes, and the monosomes are the less active, and so on. And there is some data about gradients in terms of the efficiency of translation across the sucrose gradient. So generally, you can think of it in a crude way, that the number of ribosomes per mRNA reflects the efficiency of translation, but this is not very precise because also the length of the mRNA is going to limit the number of ribosomes that you can have. A very short mRNA coding for a short protein cannot have too many ribosomes, no matter how efficiently translated. Okay. And now, of course, before I go any further into investigating these differences, I wanted to see how general this is. to what extent this is present in budding yeast, does it happen in other organisms? And mouse embryonic stem cells were the most convenient experimental system in which to confirm this finding. And here I'm showing the same sucrose gradient that they did for yeast, now done for mouse embryonic stem cells. Again, I can isolate these fractions. I can quantify the ribosomal proteins by using mass spectrometry. Here I'm showing two conditions, two biological replicates of quantifying monosomes as an estimate of my noise, and the measurement noise that they have in the system. And again, I can see that some ribosomal proteins were more enriched in the embryonic stem cells and in the monosomes, and others in the polysomes. And not only that, but the enrichments are conserved between mouse and yeast. So what I'm showing here is for each of the ribosomal proteins that have close ortholog between the two organisms, if we look at the enrichment of that protein in the polysomes, in mouse and embryonic stem cells, they show good correspondence. So one more example that I'm going to tell you about, one more example of variability in ribosomal composition before I go a little bit more in details, what this means and how does it affect phenotypes, what is the evidence for its biological significance. And in this case, the example comes from differentiating embryonic stem cells. Here you can see they're nice colonies, and they can differentiate into neuroprogenitor cells. Here stained with nesting to show that they're indeed neuroprogenitor cells. And if I quantify the ribosomal proteins in their isolated ribosomes, I can see that some of them are enriched in the neuroprogenitor cells and others are enriched in the embryonic stem cells. Now, one thing that is helping me about understanding this and these observations is that people have studied ribosomal proteins for a long time, they being components of such a conserved and important process in cells. And we have various phenotypes associated with them. So here I'm showing sets of ribosomal proteins from my embryonic stem cells. They found enriched either in monosomes, the less active ribosomes as we think, or the more active ones. And they're two observations that I want to emphasize here. One of them is that if you remember, I showed you at the beginning data for RPS19, which is involved in hematopoiesis in the diamond black fan anemia, a human condition. We know that the level of RPS19 by the haploinsufficiency, lowering the level of RPS19, can affect translation of endogenous mRNAs. And the fact that now we see it variable in unperturbed cells is quite suggestive that this variability in wild-type cells is involved, is shaping the translation of the proteome. And the other observation concerns the ribosomal proteins involved in human cancers. The ribosomal proteins that are frequently mutated in cancers, such as RPL5 that I showed you at the beginning and 10, these tend to be the ones that are loss of function, tend to be enriched in the monosomes. And the ribosomal proteins whose overexpression contributes to cancer development and progression are more enriched in polysomes. So one interpretation of this data is that part of the mutations in cancers shift the balance from less active to more active ribosomes, which might facilitate cell growth. But this is correlative, so let's do an experiment. And my experiment is going to be with yeast cells. Here I've chosen the four ribosomal proteins that do not have paralogs. There is only one such protein in the genome. And I start with four cubes of wild-type cells, and because they're wild-type cells, by definition, their fitness is one. And the question that I want to ask is whether I can predict what is the effect of deleting that ribosomal protein based on its enrichment in the polysomes. Are the ribosomal proteins more enriched in more active ribosomes going to have larger fitness defect when deleted or not? And you can make your prediction. You don't have to tell me. I'm going to play for you a movie and you can see if you're right. Ready? So what they see is that the more enriched a ribosomal protein is in the polysomes, the bigger the fitness defect of deleting it. And in this particular case with RPL38, in fact, the cells with deleted protein grow faster than the wild type cells, which is entirely consistent with this idea of shifting the distribution of ribosomes from the less active to the more active. And this trend holds.
How many generations are you going? How are you measuring growth rate?
So in this case, and this is done with the whole deletion collection. First, we sequence the collection sequence to find what is the frequency of each deletion strain. You grow them for 8 generations, and then you sequence them again and by the frequencies. That's right. That's right. And this is quite general. So I first showed you the data just for the ribosomal proteins that do not have paralogs. But if you look at across all of the ribosomal proteins, so those that have paralogs, they show a very similar trend. And now instead of showing a lot of scatter plots for all of the different conditions, I can just summarize this with a correlation. And this is what I'm showing here for all of the fractions for both glucose and the ethanol carbon source. You can see that deleting ribosomal proteins that are enriched in the monosomes tends to increase or decrease only slightly the growth rate, while deleting the ones increased in the polysomes retards growth rate much more. And a very similar trend is found in embryonic stem cells. Now, this is the slide that Boris asked for. It's one way to conceptually understand all these data. Why we should be able at all, even if there is heterogeneity of ribosomes in a cell, why should we be able to separate different ribosomes by simply doing a sucrose gradient? And the intuition for that is that different ribosomal compositions, protein compositions, correspond to different rates of initiation, different rate of elongation. Now, by changing the ribosomal composition, we can change this rate. And if the rate of initiation increases more than the rate of elongation, then the ribosomes are more likely to be found in the polysomes. And conversely, if the rate of elongation increases more than the rate of initiation, they are going to be in the monosomes.
You can make a statement stronger than that, right? And you can write down the...
I could. I want to keep it conceptual.
Initiation of elongation times length is constant, which then you can really test quantitatively.
Sure, yeah. And you can also separate different ribosomes. You can go into more details. This is just the conceptual idea why you should be able to separate different protein compositions.
I guess the reason I'm asking, before you sort of said that the rate of elongation is constant, but you can actually test that by actually scaling things properly with a length.
So the rate of elongation is... I see what you're saying. The rate of elongation can be measured directly. It's not frequently measured nowadays because they are in very convenient experimental methods. In the old days, in the 60s and 70s, people used radio pulses with radioactive isotopes to directly measure rate of elongation. So what they found is that in yeast cells or bacteria growing at different growth rates, the rate of elongation is different. The rate of elongation increases with the growth rate. Generally, nowadays, people don't frequently measure rates of elongation across different genes, which is one of the things that I'm proposing, and it's part of my future work, where we can measure directly what the rate of elongation is and then associate that with the protein composition. Now, I want to go back to this unexplained result from my doctoral work that I never knew what to do with it. Now I can ask, now that they've learned a little bit more about ribosome variability, can it possibly make any sense with this? And what essentially I can ask whether the ribosomal proteins that are enriched in the faster growing cells are going to be the ones that are found to be enriched more in monosomes and polysomes. And the answer is yes. Essentially, the more enriched a ribosomal the stronger the induction of a ribosomal protein with growth rate is, the higher the enrichment of that ribosomal protein in polysomes. So essentially, when cells grow faster, it is not only that they make more ribosomes, but then they preferentially transcribe ribosomal proteins that are a component of the faster ribosomes, which is consistent with the idea that the change in the ribosomes is facilitating the increase in growth rate. And now I want to tell you about the complication that until now I skipped. And the complication is that ribosomal proteins have a lot of paralogs. Some of them, we know that they have paralogs, or essentially proteins that have very similar but not identical sequence in the same genome. And in the case of budding yeast and flies and some model organisms, worms, we know what the paralogs are. Turns out that in the case of humans and mammals in general, we don't, because the genome encodes all these proteins that appear highly homologous. Here I'm just plotting their sequences. But there is no evidence for a lot of these proteins that they're actually expressed. So for one of them, there is protein evidence, and the other ones here are uncharacterized proteins who are known only at the level of the DNA sequence. And the reason why this is interesting, these paralogs, is because they can contribute to the diversity of ribosomes and to their function. And in particular, here is one example of RPL22E, a protein that has different isoforms in flies, in Drosophila. And the different isoforms have different localizations. So here's the germplasm, and they have different phenotypic effects when they're deleted. So in principle, it would be interesting to be able to look at these different isoforms and quantify them. The reason why this has not been done is because of the high degree of homology makes it challenging. So here on the top, I'm showing the sequence of well-annotated mouse protein that is part of SwissProt. And on the bottom is the sequence of a pseudogene. Pseudogene means people are not sure that this is actually being transcribed. And there's only one peptide that, in principle, we can ever identify and see from that gene. But one peptide it is. So with mass spectrometry, we can observe what is the spectrum of this particular peptide found only in the pseudo ribosomal protein and no other place. So on the top is the experimental, on the bottom is the theoretical spectrum. And one can compute that the probability that this spectrum corresponds to a different peptide is less than 1 per billion. But not only that, one can also match the retention times in the chromatography of this peptide, and one can modify the cysteine with chemicals, vinylpyridine or iodoacetamide, and really prove that this peptide is what it is and exists. So by doing this kind of analysis, I discovered the existence of a number of new ribosomal proteins that are encoded in the genome, but we did not know that they're expressed. And I can look at their levels of transcription across different human tissues using publicly available data. So here you can see that this is the RPL38. It's a well-annotated protein. It's being transcribed in one set of tissues. And the new protein that is homologous to RPL38 is being transcribed highly at another set of tissues. So these data are suggestive that different human tissues transcribe different paralogous isoforms of the ribosomal proteins. But these data are at the level of the mRNA. It would be very cool to be able to do this kind of analysis with the protein levels, which actually make the ribosomes, and it's what matters. And of course, there are also post-translational modifications on the ribosomal proteins that could contribute to the differences between the ribosomes. And many of you are probably familiar with the difficulties in quantifying such modifications in histones. And here is one example I'm going to show you of very, very thoroughly studied, very famous modifications of histone H3 K4 methylation. This is a very, very famous modification that regulates transcription. And if we consider another modification of the same protein, here acetylation of another lysine, there are four isoforms of this protein that might exist. And if we try to quantify them, it turns out to be exceptionally hard, because as I told you earlier in my talk, doing mass spectrometry with full proteins is very, very challenging. It's not normally not done. You have to do it with peptides. If we chop them into peptides, then you lose the information whether the two modifications serve the same protein or not. And I wanted to overcome this problem, which is a much more general problem. This is not limited just to the ribosomal proteins. This is for histones. It is for any other signal transduction pathway that involves post-translational modifications. And this is how I did it. I'm going to explain it in terms of two homologous proteins, but the idea is exactly the same with post-translational modifications, as you can see. So consider the N-termini of two homologous proteins. Now they're being digested with trypsin and they produce peptides. And some of these peptides, such as the green peptide, are going to be identical for the two proteins. And some of the peptides are going to be unique only to one protein. And when we quantify these peptides across different conditions with mass spectrometry, in the general case, the intensities that we quantify here labeled with X, this is vector because we quantify them across different conditions. They can be different time points, different tissue types, and so on. The intensity is going to be proportional to the sum of the concentrations of all the proteins from which that peptide can come. And the difficulty in solving these equations here is that this constant of proportionality is not known. It includes the efficiency of ionization of different peptides. It includes aberrations in the chromatography. It includes differences in the digestion efficiency of the proteases and so on. And they generally contribute to a lot of problems in terms of being, and they limit the accuracy with which we can infer the ratio between these different proteins. So essentially what they wanted to do here is write these equations as a couple system of equations and infer the protein levels independently from these ionization constants, from these contributions of noise that they don't know. So just to orient you, this is the data that they measure that they obtained from the mass spectrometer, where each row corresponds to a peptide, each column corresponds to a condition that is quantified. This is my garbage that they want to infer so that they can throw it out. This is a matrix that tells me whether a peptide sequence is found in a protein or not, and how many times. And this is my gold that I'm trying to uncover, because if I uncover this, I can, going back to this, I can quantify all of these isoforms independently. I can know what is the ratio among them and which isoforms are present in the general case. And the thing that makes this problem a bit, makes it to look a bit tricky, it's a matrix decomposition, is that this matrix of unknowns multiplies this matrix of unknowns. They enter non-linearly. But one can massage this, can essentially separate the matrices and reshape the problem to finding the null space of this matrix. And this matrix is entirely defined by my data. And we have a lot of efficient, both theoretical and computational approaches to characterize what the null space is and how to find it efficiently using convex optimization algorithms. But instead of going through the math, I want to show you the result from applying this on the real data, which is the ultimate evidence whether it's useful or not, whether it works. And I'll describe for you one of my favorite experiments for testing it. I start here with 48 human proteins that we can buy from Sigma. And we can modify their cysteines covalently, either with vinyl pyridine or iodoacetamide, essentially make two different modifications, post-translational modifications on the proteins. And now each peptide of these proteins that doesn't have a cysteine is going to be identical. It's a shared peptide. Each peptide that has a cysteine is going to be a unique peptide. And then I can mix them into whatever ratio I want, mix together with my proteome samples and quantify them by mass spec. So when I apply the algorithm that I just outlined for you to my data, I obtained a very good agreement between the mixing ratios in which I mix them and what they can recover, which is substantially better than what we can do with any other method. And again, the reason why it's better is because these ratios n that I infer are completely independent from all of these ionization constants. I infer them separately and they throw them away because they're just contributions of noise. So, and this, of course, needless to say, for most of you is probably quite obvious, but I'll mention it, that this is ideal to be combined with various schemes of enriching proteins for post-translational modifications, whether this is phosphorylation, ubiquitination, acetylation, and so on. And then we can put together the full set of isoforms of proteins with their post-translational modifications. But let's go back to the problem that motivated all of this, which is quantifying the pyrrolidus ribosomal proteins across the different fractions that they showed you. And here I'm showing two examples of pyrrolidus ribosomal proteins, so of either L37 or of L17. And in the case of L37, the two paralogs are almost perfectly uncorrelated with one another, which is consistent with these proteins substituting for each other. And it's interesting that L37 is also a protein that is embedded deeply into the ribosome, which explains why every ribosome would have at least one copy of the L7 type of protein. And in the case of L17, the two paralogs are perfectly correlated, which means that they're not just substituting for each other, that some ribosomes are just missing a copy of the L17 protein. So with this, I'm going to acknowledge the people who helped me and made this possible, and I'm going to take a pause for questions because you have been very quiet, and then I'm going to tell you about what I want to do in the future, about my future work. Yes, Boris.
Can I just go back for a second?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm sorry
about that. Yeah.
I can ask about this one as well.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So maybe I'll talk about this one another. So what's ultimately what's the counting? You make some rectangular matrix full of measurement, and you infer some rectangle of these protein modification forms, and you have some number of unknowns that you have to fix along the way. So what?
So probably.
So it seems like if you have enough measurements on the left, solving for it is not very hard because it's over constrained.
Right. So the question is to know which are the problems that are well constrained, that have a unique solution. And then when you have a unique solution to that problem, how can you find the optimal unique solution taking into account the errors that you have in your data? So to start with, the biological problem that motivates this is, first I want to know what is the ratio between these two proteins, which isoform is more abundant. It is very hard to do it without this model, because if I just look at, say here I have two unique peptides, X2 and X4. If I look at their intensities, the intensity of these peptides in the mass spec, X2 can be much more intense, can be much, much higher, much more intense, but I don't know why that is. Is it that this peptide ionizes more efficiently, or is it that the first protein is indeed much more abundant? So essentially the aim of the model, one of the aims, is to be able to tell you what is the ratio between these proteins completely independently of this ionization constant and this efficiency. The other one is to be able to recover these isoforms of when you don't have, when you have multiple modifications that are so far that you're never going to see them on the same peptide piece together. And then if you're saying in terms of the solution, it's just finding for any one particular problem that is being posed by the data, finding when there is a unique solution.
So maybe I can rephrase the question.
Yeah.
So on your left, you're presumably limited by how many useful modifications you can make. Right? You're making some chemical modifications.
So they actually exist.
On the right, the question is how many different states of protein you can detect, right? So at the moment you're doing it with, right?
Oh, this is a toy example, right?
Precisely. And I'm asking, so in practice, can you do 1,000?
Absolutely, easily. Yeah. The question is.
Not entirely obvious because it's only exponential in sort of number modifying.
It depends, right? So it depends whether the problem is going to be well constrained or not. So if you have.
That's what I'm asking. So mm-hmm. what?
Oh, what's what fraction?
Realistically, mm-hmm. what is possible?
Ooh.
Right.
Sorry.
You need more measurements than unknowns.
I misunderstood. So actually, in terms of so each set of homologous proteins which share a peptide, they're going to form such a problem if you imagine a shotgun quantification of the proteome of any one organism across a number of conditions. For each set of homologous proteins with their PTNs, there is a problem to be solved. And realistically, over 80% of the proteins, over 80% of these problems that come from real data have a unique solution, are well constrained by the data, and therefore they can be quantified. And from this 80%, for 90% plus of them, the quality of the data are good enough to be quantified. And then for the other, you mathematically you should be able to get an answer, but you can see that the data don't really fit well. So you say, no, my error bar here is too large. But in the majority of cases, you can do that. You can do it very well, especially when you have homologous proteins. PTNs are a little bit trickier because there are the number of possible isoforms does grow combinatorially, and then you run out of power. But in terms of homologous proteins, there are the number of isoforms doesn't grow combinatorially, the number of possible isoforms with the number of peptides, and they're fairly well constrained. And then even with a smallish problem like this, where you have two modifications on the two ends of the protein, this is impossible to do with any other methods, really. You have to go to a national lab, superconducting magnet, try to run the whole protein, and it becomes a large project on its own for a single protein. And with this, you can actually do it high throughput across the protein.
Hey, so question?
Yes, please.
So I think there's a fair amount known about the crystal structure of ribosome.
Wonderful.
Where do they fit? Number one. I have another question too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. That's a fantastic question. This is the crystal structure of the yeast ribosome, and they have color-coded the ribosomal proteins based on their abundances in the polysomes. And in general, we see that the variable ribosomal proteins are all on the surface of the ribosome, which is consistent with the possibility that they associate and reassociate. And also, I'm actually looking and seeing some evidence. This is a work in progress. I haven't completed it. But in principle, if to the extent that there was heterogeneity in the ribosomes used for crystallizing and making the crystals, I should be able to observe corresponding differences in the electron density and the diffraction pattern from ribosome crystals. And I think I can see that. It's not completed, but the crystal structure itself, when the data are reanalyzed, can actually provide further evidence that indeed ribosomal proteins are changing it.
In one of your early slides, you seem to show, one of those heat maps, you seem to show a difference between the trisomes and tetrasomes.
Right.
That surprised me a little bit because there's noise in there depending on the length of the message, and I was surprised that you had that degree of resolution in seeing differences. I wouldn't a priori think that level existed.
Right. So that difference is small. You're right. Between the trisomes in different conditions, they do seem different. So the way I think of it is that when you separate ribosomes by sucrose gradients, this separation is clearly imperfect. There are clearly different fractions in the different ribosomal compositions in each fraction. So what they measure is the population average of some superposition of different ribosomes. And essentially, in those two very different conditions of growth, very fast growth in glucose and much slower growth in ethanol, I have enough of a difference in the composition of the ribosomes in general that the composition that corresponds to the trisomes is different. And my measurement, the measurement error that they have with mass spec is between 5 and 10%. And the magnitude of these changes is about 3-4-fold higher. And they do see it reproducible across biological replicates, so I think it's real. But that's smaller. The bigger difference is between the monosomes and the polysomes. Yeah, it's a good observation. Very good.
So the general feeling is that cells are limited in growth by how many ribosomes they have, how much protein synthesis they can do. So the yeast in your yeast experiments, the ones that are growing fastest, presumably a great deal of the transcription of protein synthesis are actually ribosomal protein being made. So how does that influence? Because if you have nascent chains on those polysomes that are more likely to have ribosomal proteins, how does that bias your measurements?
So there are two arguments why this is not so not a very big effect that does not contribute much to measurements. One of them, which is actually the simpler, is that if you look at the embryonic stem cells, the polysome gradient. In fact, let's go there. The sucrose gradient. Yeah. So these fractions here, they correspond to having 10 and more ribosomes per messenger RNA. The mRNAs for most ribosomal proteins are too short.
Right.
To
it's not relevant for this system, but for yeast, it certainly will be at fast growth rates. I'm pretty sure that most of the transcription and protein
synthesis
is supporting ribosome biogenesis. So.
So in the case,
where it could actually play a role in your
that's right. So in the case of the mouse embryonic stem cells, it's clear it doesn't. In the case of yeast, the reason why I don't think that plays a big role is when I look at the intensities of N and C-terminal peptides for the same ribosomal protein, their distributions of intensities are quite comparable. So it doesn't seem like there are a lot more N-terminal peptides.
Can you say something about, in the yeast case, so I guess what I'm asking is, are there more proteins than those four that don't have paralogs that are sort of optional? So in your plot, it looked like, in the three-dimensional image of the ribosome, it looks like there's varying numbers of quite a few of the proteins. So there are incomplete, if you want to call them that, ribosomes. At all levels of monosome through polysome, that's correct. For sort of what fraction of proteins then, and are they genetically sort of dispensable?
So, what fraction of the ribosomal proteins are genetically dispensable? In the case of the ribosomal proteins that do not have paralogs, it's about a third of them are genetically dispensable. In the case of the ribosomal proteins that do have paralogs, it's about two-thirds. It's a higher fraction than that they're not essential.
Yes.
Yeah. And then in terms of the variability, if I discount the noise and they look at the ribosomal proteins that I'm confident are variable across these fractions, there are about 25 of them out of 80 that I see vary.
The ribosomes are incomplete with.
That's right. That's right. There are some ribosomes that may not have a copy of that ribosomal protein. That's right.
So the ones that slow down growth in a test tube, what do they do in nature that promotes fitness?
Oh, there are very many possibilities for them. I can speculate a little bit, but one possibility is that there's a trade-off between kinetic proofreading and speed of translation. For some proteins, it might be more important that you make them faster and you can tolerate higher error rate, or you can have the other way around. You can also have pausing, which I think is a very interesting possibility. You could have initiation on the mRNAs, where the ribosomes are waiting for a signal to start translating. And in fact, this is quite suggestive in terms of, if you look at the sucrose gradients from slowly growing cells, the monosomal peak is usually much higher than the polysomal peak, which might be a lot of ribosomes that are paused waiting for a signal to start translating. Essentially, the translation itself can be as highly regulated as transcription. Which is consistent with the fact that 50% of the variance in the abundance of proteins is explained by translation, not by transcription.
The paralogs that are growth promoting, are they more evolutionary conserved than the paralogs that are on the monosomes?
I haven't looked at that. Evolutionarily, they're about 40% identity, 50 to 40% identity between mouse and yeast ribosomes. And the bigger difference is that mammalian ribosomes are actually substantially larger than yeast ones, and they have these extension segments that are called. They have additional polypeptide chains that are attached, which by itself is quite suggestive that these machines accounting for 40-50% of the protein of fast-growing cells. If they're growing so much in size and adding other segments, these segments are likely to be functional because they're expensive. It's a little bit of an evolutionary argument.
So if we just accept that the elongation is a constant and you have various paralogs, then the most obvious possibility in terms of function is specificity. And so is there any evidence that specificity of translation of certain RNAs is affected by different paralogs?
So the in terms of paralogs, so the best example of specificity of mRNA being determined by binding to a ribosomal protein that they know of is RPL38 binding the Hox mRNAs. Then there is a specific interaction between the UTRs of the Hox mRNAs that confers the translational specificity. And if you take that UTR and put it on a reporter, you make the reporter translation dependent on the RPL38. In terms of the paralogous proteins, there are quite a few reports, actually, lots of reports of people who have claimed specificity of one paralog having different function versus another. A good fraction of these claims have been questioned to what extent the difference is due to different levels and different regulation of the paralogs rather than different function. So it could be that, just to be devil's advocate, it could be that the two paralogs actually have the same biochemical function, but they have very different transcriptional regulation. Now, if I delete paralog A, I get different phenotype in a condition because paralog B is not induced in that condition. So it's not that paralog B cannot compete for it, but it's not expressed. Now, in some cases, people have shown that this is not what's happening. They have overexpressed B and tried to argue that it's really a distinct biochemical function. But essentially, I'm giving you a sense that the literature there with the paralogs has some competing claims of people who have actively asserted and made claims and careful measurements showing that different paralogs do appear to have different biochemical functions, and other people thinking that a lot of it is related to distinct transcriptional regulation. So we have.
Can you say anything about the heterogeneity that might exist between ribosomes that have been on a messenger for various lengths of time? So how much heterogeneity, could any of the heterogeneity be explained by, you know, how recently it was initiated?
Well,
mentioned pausing, so that would also play.
Right. So pausing is something that they think is quite exciting. There isn't, people generally don't measure what is the rate of ribosomes moving on mRNAs. You could do that with very stark perturbations, Harringtonian and so on, but there isn't a lot of direct data on that. It's one of the things that I would like to do. As we discuss my future aims, we'll talk about it. Generally, people don't think that when ribosomes translate, they change. Ribosomes are believed to be constant. They translate the message, they finish, and then they start translating another message. There are some very interesting reports that there's interaction between ribosomes and the same message polysomes. And these reports have not so much focused on that somehow ribosomes change as part of this interaction, but that might very well be happening in part. I don't think we should have data for it. I don't think it's well understood, at least. Yeah. I want to tell you about what I'm going to do. Should I do that now? Okay. Okay. So very quickly, I want to understand how different ribosomes and ribosome modifications regulate protein synthesis. And for this, I want to use as experimental systems yeast cells growing at different growth rates and different nutrient limitations, and stem cells differentiating to neuroprogenitor cells. In particular, neurons are a very interesting cell type in which to study ribosome specialization, because one of the intriguing possibilities is that these different ribosomes have different subcellular distributions that regulate translation in a location-dependent manner. And as I discussed with some of you today, there is an interesting observation of mRNAs coding for core ribosomal proteins being transported to synapses and dendrites and being translated there so they can contribute to local modification of the ribosomes within the synapses. And the first thing that they would like to do to begin characterizing more broadly and globally the role of ribosomes in regulating translation is to be able to separate different types of ribosomes more cleanly. So it's been very fortunate that they can get some level of separation by doing sucrose gradients, but obviously sucrose gradients don't separate pure populations of ribosomes. So one way to separate ribosomes is by using antisense RNA that is complementary to the mRNA and has biotin. So it hybridizes, and then I can pull the antisense RNA, and because the ribosome binds the mRNA so strongly, I pull together the ribosome, and by mass spec, I can characterize the ribosome and the RNA by RNA-seq. Of course, this can give me association between mRNAs and specific ribosomes, but I'm interested in function. And the function of ribosomes is to translate. So to be able to measure elongation rate, initiation rate directly, I'm going to measure protein levels by doing a pulse chase of heavy amino acids. And then I can measure by mass spec as the light protein decreases in abundance. And that gives me the degradation rate, and the rate of increase of heavy protein gives me directly the rate of new protein being synthesized. And for this, I need only mass conservation to apply mass conservation in direct data. And if I combine this kind of data with data for ribosome density from ribosome profiling, I can estimate directly both the rate of initiation of new ribosomes hopping on mRNAs and the rate of elongation. And then I can associate this, the different rates of elongation and initiation with the specificities of binding to messages. I want to complete the characterization of the isoforms and the PTM modifications that contribute to making different ribosomes and regulating their function. And of course, with emphasis on being able to do this directly at the level of the protein. And to complement this more biochemical aims that I first mentioned that on wild-type cells, I want to use genetics to test for both functional importance. In particular, if I find that some ribosomal proteins are much more enriched in neuroprogenitor cells, and these ribosomal proteins are predominantly associated with genes that are important for neurons and neuroprogenitors, but not embryonic stem cells. I want to be able to test that by genetically knocking them down or deleting them. And in particular, I should be able to observe what is the effect on differentiation, preventing or slowing down differentiation, and also seeing specifically that I can affect the translation of the subset of the mRNAs that were bound by these proteins and not more generally. So it's essentially the genetics can provide an orthogonal independent way to verify the findings from the first aims and then provide new hypotheses and to be tested in wild-type cells using mass spectrometry and pull-downs. And of course, we'll have a lot more time to discuss my aims tomorrow during my job talk.
So, what kind of name? What kind of resolution are you seeking using cryo-EM?
At the level of the protein, and proteins are large enough, so that's entirely. I think it's entirely doable.
So you're talking about the angstrom level?
No, larger than angstrom. Okay. Yeah. I'm interested in being able to see protein present, protein absent. And also, in doing that, I can combine it with existing references of what the ribosome looks like, which makes it even easier. Yeah. No, I certainly cannot see angstrom, and I don't expect to be able to see.
Well, they have these super cryo-EM where people have gone down to like 3.5 angstrom.
Yeah. Well, maybe, if that's possible. I don't depend on it. If I can do it, that's a super bonus, that's great. But I don't think that I have to do it too.
The problem that you alluded to on translation of the synapse is it's an interesting spatial problem there with regard to the number of different messages that are being translated to support the synapse versus the number of ribosomes that you can sort of pack in into a spine and that kind of thing. I wonder if you have any thoughts about that sort of spatial organization. Given what the size of ribosomes.
Well, we know that changes in translational efficiency participate in long-term potentiation and in learning. They're part of the functioning of the synapse. In terms of number of ribosomes per synapse, how many per synapse, what they know is that mRNAs coding for the core ribosomal proteins are among the most numerous, oftentimes the most abundant mRNAs in the synapse. So they don't appear to be a contamination. Number of ribosomes, there are probably a few ribosomes per synapse. But I don't have more exact numbers. And I guess in part, not sure that these numbers, how would you determine these numbers? You could label a ribosomal protein that you believe is present in most ribosomes fluorescently and be able to count it. But I don't know a very accurate estimates number of ribosomes. I would assume a few per synapse or something along these lines. But in general, there are in neurons are an obvious example of a highly specialized cell whose spatial structure and morphology is important for its function. But also in developing embryos, that's clearly the case. That there's a lot of localized translation that is important. Different ribosomes are an obvious way to achieve that. The extent to which they're involved in this has never been studied, and we'll just have to see it. But I should add to these aims of being able to separate ribosomes by pulling down with immune precipitating the protein and pulling on the mRNA with neurons and embryos, one can also physically cut the material and separate it. So that's that makes it even easier. All right.
Cool.